Good afternoon. I'm Dr. David Blumenthal, president of the Commonwealth Fund. Thank you for joining us to hear about a new study from the Commonwealth Fund and the Urban Institute entitled Comparing Health Insurance Reform Options from Building on the ACA to Single Payer. On the call with me today, we have Sarah Collins, vice president for the Commonwealth Fund's program on healthcare coverage and access, and the report authors at the Urban Institute, Linda Blumberg and John Hollihan. Before we begin, a reminder that the information discussed on this call is embargoed until 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time on Wednesday, October 16th. The study we are releasing tomorrow looks at 8 different health reform options and their potential effects on critical pieces of U.S. healthcare, health insurance coverage, national healthcare costs, and spending. The analysis is part of an ongoing body of work at the Commonwealth Fund, where we regularly evaluate the impact of health policies on people and our healthcare system. We believe it is important to evaluate the impact of all proposals, from those that build on the Affordable Care Act to wholesale health system overhauls. That way, policymakers and the public can better understand the direction any given policy or candidate is likely to take us. This study is important because it shows that there are several health reform approaches that have the potential to increase the number of people with health insurance, make healthcare more affordable, and slow cost growth. But they achieve these results in different ways and to varying degrees. And the details matter. Those details will be central to the national debate on healthcare and health insurance coverage as the 2020 campaign season progresses. Looking back on the past decade, the Affordable Care Act is proof that we can make progress in healthcare in America, expand coverage to millions of Americans, and make it possible for people with pre-existing conditions to get covered and afford healthcare. This analysis provides exciting insights into how we can keep that momentum going. I'll turn now to Sarah Collins briefly, and then we will hear from Linda Blumberg and John Hollihan and take your questions.
Thank you, David. As David mentioned, the Affordable Care Act has dramatically improved health insurance coverage and affordability, but significant problems remain. 27 million people are still uninsured. An estimated 44 million people are underinsured, and healthcare costs are growing faster than median income in most states. Polls indicate that healthcare is top of mind among voters, and several Democratic presidential candidates and members of Congress have proposed ways to expand coverage and improve affordability. But a recent Commonwealth Fund survey suggests that people are confused about what some of these proposals might mean for them and the healthcare system and what the trade-offs are. For example, when asked whether they were in favor of a Medicare for All type approach to expanding coverage, 40% of adults said they did not know enough to form an opinion about it. Given the complexity of our healthcare system, this may also be the case regarding other approaches to improving coverage, including those advanced by Republicans. The Commonwealth Fund, in our support of the Urban Institute's work, believed it was important to help voters and policymakers understand the facts about what the range of current health reform proposals might mean for Americans and for the healthcare system, and what financing trade-offs might be required to implement them. The idea was not to model the exact parameters of proposals, but to select a range of policy options that are similar to the approaches under debate and therefore illustrative of what their potential effects might be. Our hope is that this extensive analysis will clarify for voters and policymakers the implications of the policy choices before us. Thank you, and now I'll turn this over to Linda Blumberg and John Hollihan.
Hello, this is John Hollihan, and I will start with an overview of what we did. I'll start with slide 2, which is titled Analysis of 8 Reform Options. So we looked at 8 different alternatives. The first 4 reforms add incrementally to the ACA and build upon one another in steps. They improve premium and cost-sharing subsidies and expand eligibility for assistance, particularly in states that haven't expanded Medicaid. We bring healthier people back into the insurance pool, ending health plans that aren't ACA compliant, and we introduce cost containment through the introduction of a public option. The fifth and sixth reforms also build on 1 through 4, but add an auto enrollment feature, which results in universal coverage for all legally present U.S. residents. And then we further improve affordability, including provisions, some provisions for workers. Reforms 7 and 8 are, we call single-payer light and single-payer enhanced. They both are single-payer health insurance plans that cover everyone, and there is no private coverage. The difference are in benefits and cost sharing and whether there is coverage for undocumented immigrants. The main, when we look at results, the main things we focus on are the change in the uninsured brought about by the option or the reform, the change in federal spending and the effects on the federal budget, and the change in national health spending, which means household spending plus employer spending, state government spending, and federal government spending. We include 4 different ways to achieve universal coverage. We show the trade-offs across reform options. For example, the greater the savings to households or the more affordable the reform, the greater the increase in federal government spending. Universal coverage will require some people to pay premiums or taxes that they might have preferred not have chosen to do. In other words, it can't be voluntary. And the greater the savings in national health spending, the greater need for regulation and provider payment rates. The reforms we estimate and we talk about in this report are estimated as if they're fully in place in 2020. We estimate government revenues that are needed, but not how to get them or who pays those new revenues. And now I'll turn it over to Linda to go through the results.
Hi. I'll turn to slide 4. Which is the one that says reforms 1 through 4 at the top. In order not to take up too much time, I'm going to talk through some top-line findings on just a selection of the 8 reforms we simulated, but we can answer questions about all 8 if you have them. And as John noted, the first 4 reforms in 4 incremental steps show how coverage and spending are affected by a set of reforms that include making marketplace premium and cost-sharing subsidies more generous for those currently eligible for them, and extending them to higher income people as well, adding a permanent reinsurance program, restoring the individual mandate penalties and reversing the expansion of substandard or short-term plans, filling in the Medicaid coverage gap in the 17 states that have not expanded eligibility under the ACA, adding a limited auto enrollment program for most people enrolled in SNAP or TANF, and adding a public option. The combined effect of all of these reforms, which is shown on this slide as Reform 4, is an increase in insurance coverage or a decrease in the uninsured of almost 11 million people. Filling the Medicaid gap is critical to getting this large of an increase in coverage, as is the limited auto enrollment program and enhancing the marketplace subsidies. We show that this expansion of coverage can be achieved while keeping total national health spending by all private and public payers constant, but doing that requires the public option added in Reform 4. The public option lowers the marketplace premiums. Lower marketplace premiums lower the federal marketplace subsidy costs, and lower subsidy costs mean lower federal spending increases. Under this set of reforms, spending by the federal government increases to pay for more people getting coverage through Medicaid and with marketplace subsidies, but the federal cost is significantly lower than what it would be without the public option to hold down marketplace subsidy costs. We estimate that federal spending would increase by $46.7 billion in 2020, or $590 billion over 10 years. If you flip to the next slide, Reform 5 adds to Reform 4 by eliminating what's often called the employer-sponsored insurance firewall that prevents people with offers of health insurance from their employers that are deemed affordable to them from getting subsidies in the marketplaces. So we lift that restriction, and we add what we call CARE, which is a set of reforms that ensures that all legally present U.S. residents have insurance coverage, even those that don't voluntarily sign up for it on their own. This set of reforms reduces the uninsured by about 80%, or 25.6 million people. employer coverage does decrease by about 10%, however, as more mostly modest income people take up subsidized coverage in the marketplaces instead of from their employers. And the additional coverage and subsidization of more people increases federal spending by $122 billion in 2020, or about $1.5 trillion over 10 years. National spending would fall here, however, by less than 1%. This overall but small system savings is attributable to more people obtaining lower-priced insurance coverage through the marketplaces. We'll flip to slide six to talk about Reform 7, which we call our single-payer light reform. And under this reform, everyone legally present in the U.S. obtains insurance coverage that meets the ACA's benefit standards through a single government-structured and administered insurance plan. There would be no private insurance, but there would be some income-related cost-sharing. Standard coverage would be at the ACA's gold plan level, the 80% actuarial value level. And under this plan, like under Reforms 5 and our Reform 6 that I'm not talking about at the moment, 25.6 million legal residents would gain insurance coverage. However, unlike Reforms 5 and 6, an additional 4.2 million undocumented immigrants who have private insurance today, either through employers or purchased with their own money in the private non-group market, would become uninsured due to the elimination of private insurance. So on net, the number of uninsured drops by 21.4 million people, leaving 10.8 million people, all undocumented residents, uninsured. Federal spending under this reform increases by $1.5 trillion in 2020 and $17.6 trillion over 10 years. This is over 11 times the increase in federal spending that we showed under Reform 5, since it moves almost all the private and state spending under that reform onto the federal bill. Direct household spending on health care would drop dramatically, though, by 72% overall, and national spending would decrease by over $210 billion in 2020, or about 6%. This savings comes from moving all legal residents into a government insurance plan that pays providers at lower payment rates than current commercial insurers. We flip to slide seven. Our last reform package is another single-payer approach, single-payer enhanced, that covers all U.S. residents, regardless of legal status, adds additional benefits beyond those included in the ACA's essential health benefits, like adult dental, vision, hearing, and a new home and community-based long-term services and supports benefit, eliminates all consumer out-of-pocket costs, again, eliminating all private insurance. And here, the U.S. would have no remaining uninsured, although there's some additional uncertainty around this estimate. We can discuss later if you're interested. All household health care spending and state health care spending is eliminated, except for a small share associated with institutional long-term care. Federal spending would increase, however, by $2.8 trillion in 2020 and $34 trillion over 10 years, about 87% more than single-payer light. In addition, national health spending would increase by $720 billion, about 20% in 2020, compared to a decrease under our other universal coverage approaches. National spending increases here because of the broader benefits provided, the higher use of care resulting from elimination of all cost-sharing expenses to consumers, and the additional coverage for about 11 million undocumented residents. And now, if you can flip to the last slide, I just want to note a handful of issues that ideally we'd spend a whole separate conversation on, but are very important when thinking about the implications of different reforms. So I'm going to just touch on each here briefly. First, reforms including a public option, our reforms 4 through 6, and single-payer reforms like our reforms 7 and 8, all rely on a price-regulated insurance market. In the case of the public option reforms, price regulation in the individual insurance markets is how that works. In the case of single-payer reforms, price regulation is applied to everyone. However, the optimal levels at which the payment rates for hospitals and doctors and other providers should be paid are really unknown at this time, yet that issue has very large implications for government costs. Second, phase-in periods for reforms get much more important the larger the changes being made to the healthcare system, and these have large implications for costs in the 10-year budget window. We did not develop phase-in periods for the reforms here for ease of comparison of the packages to each other. Third, as employer health spending decreases, it doesn't necessarily mean that employer spending as a whole goes down, since health insurance spending will get passed back to workers over time as higher wages. Fourth, we haven't simulated specific tax policies to fund these reforms, and how that is done is likely to vary a lot by income, and thus the overall financial effects of these reforms once funded, and how those are going to impact different households differently is a big issue to be looked at more seriously once folks settle down on how they might want to fund these different kinds of reforms. And finally, we're hoping to have highlighted the critical trade-offs in designing reforms intended to expand coverage and improve affordability. In order to reduce household costs, government costs must increase. Voluntary reforms will never get you to universal coverage, but reforms that guarantee universal coverage will require some people to do things they would otherwise choose not to do. And the more national cost savings that are achieved through lower prices paid to providers, the greater the potential disruption to the provider system. So with that, I will pause, and we're happy to take any questions that you might have.
And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Star 1 on your touchtone phone. We'll take our first question from Jack O'Brien with Health Leaders Magazine. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Excellent. Thank you for hosting this again. This is really more of a two-part question. I'm curious for our audience, which is primarily hospital and health system executives, what can they expect in terms of a public option or a single-payer system being implemented affecting their bottom line? And any sort of insights on how that would affect their operations would be helpful.
So this is David Blumenthal. If I understand your question, you're asking about the likelihood that a public option will be implemented and what would happen after that. Is that the correct interpretation?
Yep.
It's hard enough to model these technically without modeling the politics as well. So I think that we're not here to speculate about the way the result, the election will turn out or who will advocate what. I think there are others who are better equipped to speculate about that than we are.
If I could follow up on the second part of the conversation, though, what would the impact be of a single payer or even a public option in terms of how their operations go? I think that would be something they would be interested in.
Well, I think that depends entirely on what the what our public leaders, as a result of the political process, decide to do with respect to payment rates. And that, again, is something that's very hard to predict or speculate about. And there are a vast range of generous or less generous rates of payment that could be decided upon, and those would be critical. Obviously, there would be a very, very active discussion of that item should a public option actually be included in legislation that passes and is signed by the president.
We did make some assumptions about what the provider payment rates would be or how the premiums would change under a public option in the reforms that we modeled. What we did was we had a proxy for what those rates would be in the public option as what the premiums would be if it was a market that was very highly competitive, because that's something that we can measure. So competitive, having at least 5 or more competing insurers in the individual market and having reasonably competitive hospital markets. And that was our proxy both for roughly Medicare rates and rates that we thought would be potentially attainable in the non-group market. And I think one of the things that is important to remember is that when you're looking at the public option versus the single-payer reforms, that you're talking about rates being regulated in a smaller percentage of the insured population under the public option. So the impacts on providers, even if the rates have come down, are going to be smaller than under a single-payer option where the regulated rates affect all patients that would be seen by the providers. And on the side of you know, additional revenues when you're, if you're enhancing subsidies at the same time, you're also increasing the number of people accessing services, and so additional revenues may be coming in from greater insurance coverage enrollment. So all of those things need to be balanced in terms of thinking about the impacts on providers, but we have not taken these particular reforms and estimated impacts on different kinds of providers at this point in terms of total revenues.
But the cost estimates do reflect provider payment rates that are approximately Medicare levels, and if that's not, you know, because David Blumenthal said, as that isn't the way it works out, then the cost would be somewhat higher than we're estimating there.
All right. Thank you.
We'll take our next question from Ronald Brownstein with The Atlantic. Please go ahead. Your line's open.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I had a two-part question as well, kind of par for the course here. First part is option 8 that you have here, essentially the single-payer plan that has been introduced in Congress? And secondly, when you look at the difference in total cost for the federal government between 7 and 8, how much of that difference is attributable to 8 covering undocumented immigrants?
Okay, so
go ahead.
So we did not specifically simulate any of the bills in Congress. We were trying to include a lot of the components of those bills, but those bills were not actually written in a way where the specifics were so clear that we could actually simulate them. And so what we have assumed here is that we would pay roughly, the providers would be paid roughly Medicare rates. We have increased that above current Medicare rates on the hospital side by 15% since current Medicare rates are estimated to be somewhat below hospital costs. And we assumed that if you were going to do this for the population writ large, you'd have to at least cover those costs. And, you know, we have a home and community-based long-term services and support estimate in here that is, I think, of a flavor of that in one of the bills. But, you know, again, we had to make some assumptions and put some limits on in order to make it estimatable. So in terms of how much of the difference is associated with the undocumented population being covered, let's see. So I think this is right. I think the 218. So the $218 billion of the difference between Reform 7 and 8 is attributable to the larger enrollment of people under 8.
And that's year one, Linda? It's just in year one?
That's the year one. And, you know, and it's I mean, that is if that population was just excluded and everything else stayed the same.
And just to follow up on my first question, I mean, but the basic provisions that you're examining in 8, no copay, no private insurance, expanded benefits, that is that the one that is most similar to the single-payer proposals that are in Congress of
that
the
is 8? It is the most similar, but it is not precisely those.
Okay, right. Right.
I think it's important, as David Blumenthal, it's important to know that these plans, these models do not precisely replicate any particular plan, but they do represent the major options that are available to people who are planning health care reforms.
Right. Okay.
We'll take our next question from Rick Newman with Yahoo Finance. Please go ahead.
Hey everybody. Does anybody know which of these options models Joe Biden's plan, which is obviously not Medicare for all, but a new public option and enhanced ACA? And also, when you look at these, is there, just looking at the economics of them, is there any way to identify any one of these options that seems to be the optimal approach?
We think the Biden plan, as we understand it, is sort of a mix of our Reform 4 and 5. And I don't think we have ourselves formulated a view as to what we think is best, and that really depends on your goals, I think.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, what we're trying to highlight here is the trade-offs and costs for various different payers and coverage, and allow people to identify their own sense of what is optimal based on their values and objectives.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from Lilo Stanton with our New Jersey Spotlight. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I was curious, I'm very struck by how the different options appear to sort of reflect or echo what some of the states have done on their own. So obviously I cover New Jersey. You know, they have, they now have an individual mandate. They have reinsurance. They expanded Medicaid. So I'm curious if, first of all, if it seems that these reforms all would sort of build out some of those kinds of reforms into a national plan, if, first of all, if that's a fair assessment as you move through the different reforms. And secondly, how do you, if any one of these are to be done on a national level, it appears that you're going to have states that are going to be winners and losers because some states have already taken some of these steps themselves. Does anyone want to talk about how that would have to be sort of figured in, or is that part of that political calculation that you didn't do? Because some of these are already in place in some parts of America, obviously.
Sure. Some components are, so as you said, some states have an individual mandate, some have reinsurance. We took that into account in our estimates. And so when we move from having no individual mandate penalties back to having mandate penalties, that revenue is coming off of the state side and going on to the federal side to the extent that revenue is collected on the individual mandate penalties. The states who have reinsurance programs in place and are contributing towards the cost of those, they're getting savings, and that those costs are now absorbed within the federal system. The enhanced subsidies that start in our first step, our Reform 1, and carry through Reform 5 and are built on from there, There really isn't a state that has enhanced subsidies as generous as those. You have a couple of states, Vermont and Massachusetts, that have been adding additional subsidies. California is going to, but they didn't have a schedule yet specified. But none of those states, even the two states that have already put enhanced subsidies in place, have done anything that was this comprehensive. On the Medicaid side, what we did in terms of filling in the Medicaid gap specifically in the non-expansion states was we lowered eligibility for the subsidies in the marketplaces, including that these are enhanced subsidies under our approach, to just above Medicaid eligibility in all of those non-expansion states to allow those folks who are currently cut out from any assistance to get them generous subsidized coverage through the marketplaces in those 17 states. Because, as you said, many states have already expanded Medicaid, and it seemed unfair to just buy out the states that hadn't done that while the other states were paying 10% of their expansion population costs, we included in our costs the federal government picking up that 10% from the expansion states on the expansion populations in order to make it more even. So that was how we dealt with that.
Okay, so essentially they wouldn't pay for having already gone through the work themselves. They wouldn't have to pay for others to do that same expansion.
Well, it would all be federalized, so that 10% that the expansion states are paying would be part of the federal bill, as would the eligibility for subsidies for that Medicaid gap population that we're taking in.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take our next question from Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar with the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. And I was wondering, on reform number 8, that large increase in federal revenue needed, almost $2.7 trillion annually. Is there any way to do that without a broad-based tax?
As Linda and John specified, and this is Dave Blumenthal, we have not modeled the tax implications of this.
Is this David talking
yes,
now?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we've please go ahead.
We've not modeled the tax and revenue implications or options. I don't think we can comment on the question you just asked.
But just based on your general familiarity with the tax system and the ability of the federal government to raise that kind of money, do you see any way to do it without a broad-based tax?
Ricardo, you're forcing me to reach back to my public finance course in graduate school, which was 1975.
Which you aced, right? You aced that one.
Absolutely. Though, but it's a little foggy right now, so I don't want my professor to get irritated with me. So I think I'll pass on that question.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll go next to Peter Sullivan with The Hill. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have a two-part question. The first is kind of technical. I'm just wondering on Reform 8, in Table 16, you list two different numbers for the 10-year cost. One of them is 33,988, and then one of them is 32,15. My understanding is one of them takes into account the income tax feedback, I guess, basically. So if we're just looking for a headline 10-year cost of Reform 8, which of those numbers do you think is more, the cost? I mean, it sounds like maybe it's the $32 trillion because that's after the income taxes are taken into account?
I think it's probably clear to most people. They go with the one that's closer to 34, but as employers pass these savings back on in terms of higher wages, federal revenues will go up as a result. So the amount that needs to be financed is the lower number, the 32. So you can really use either one, but I think most people probably would find it easier to get their heads around the 34, but the 32 is very meaningful as well.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. That's good.
We'll take our next question from Amy Lotzen with Inside Health Policy. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I'm going to go back to what somebody else had mentioned before about the Medicare rates. I was sort of wondering, you have Washington State that tried to do a 100% Medicare levels for their public option, but ended up at 160, and then you have in Colorado, I think they ended up at 175. And I guess I wanted to ask, first of all, are you planning on watching to see what's going to happen with those public options over the next year and perhaps make changes to your model? And second of all, what does the situation in those states make you think about the possibility of actually getting to a flat Medicare reimbursement level?
Many of these proposals have talked about using Medicare rates or something close to it, and so that informed our thinking about what we wanted to do. The numbers you mentioned, those two states really refer to hospitals, I'm pretty sure, and we're going to be sort of increasing rates for current Medicare and Medicaid, bringing down the higher commercial rates. But it is a big change, and we discussed that at some length in this paper, that even though this is the way we modeled it, to get there could take a long time and be very difficult to do. But we had to hang this on something, and that's what we did.
But I think, you know, the phase in conversation, which we just touched on briefly at the beginning and the end of our presentation, really speaks to this. And I think it does relate to where we are with some of these other states, which is, you know, where you start is, you know, potentially merely the start, right? And part of it is getting some experience with seeing how providers are able to cut costs and become more efficient. And perhaps, you know, I think any of us would say it would be unwise to go from where we are now down to Medicare rates in one step, in one moment. And that thinking about that path from where we are now to potentially where we might want to be in the future is a really important conversation to have. And that path would require, from my perspective, a lot of monitoring and evaluation to assess that as rates were being brought down over time, that it was the right balance between cost savings and access and quality of care. And that's why we think, you know, phasing in lower rates somewhat slowly and over time would be a very important thing here. We didn't do that in this analysis because we wanted to be able to have more straightforward comparisons across different types of reforms, but we do think that's a very important consideration.
Thank you.
This is Sarah, too. I just, you know, the states that are already moving forward on the public option provides a unique opportunity to get to learn more about how this would work. And in fact, it also suggests that there are different approaches to doing a lot of the reforms that are done in this report and are being talked about on the campaign trail. And one of those is to experiment with the public plan over time and fold it in state by state in states that have less competitive markets, for example, and just have a better sense of how that might work and where the pressure points are for providers.
And I, Dave Blumenthal, I just want to point out one perspective on the reductions in payments that are hypothesized to occur under a public option is that they are potentially dangerous in compromising the quality of care and access to care to those institutions that are experiencing reduced revenues. Another point of view is to look internationally, which we do a lot at the Commonwealth Fund, and recognize that in the United States we use about the same amount of service that the rest of the world, developed world does. The reason we cost twice as much as the nearest competitor is because our prices are so high compared to what is paid in the rest of the world, where outcomes of care are as good or better. So I think as you look, take a long view of the price controversy, you have to look at both sides of that controversy and recognize that we also have lots of markets, at least the great majority of markets, where there is no competition because there is such consolidation within those markets. So we don't have a way of setting prices that is reflective of the underlying cost of providing the services.
Thank you.
And as a reminder, star and one for any further questions today. Star and one. We'll go next to Harris Meyer with Modern Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. There's a study, Wool Handler study, coming out tomorrow that basically finds that ACA and Medicare did not increase doctor visits or procedures. And, of course, Dr. Wool Handler says the cost of Medicare for All is being overestimated. I was just wondering how your analysis looks at utilization impacts. I know you talked about the lack of cost sharing in the reform option 8, but I'm wondering throughout all the options whether you're envisioning or building in an increase in utilization and how that compares to what Dr. Wool Handler and her colleagues found.
We definitely, within the models that we use, rely on the best economic research and analysis of how utilization spending on medical care increases with lower prices facing the consumer. And those elasticities, which have been demonstrated over time and the best research out there, are built into these models. So, yes, as prices, out-of-pocket costs to consumers go down, utilization goes up according to those elasticities. And, for example, the elasticities are larger for people who spend little than compared to people who are quite ill and using a lot of medical care today, for, you know, which makes sense, right? If you have a lot, if you are very seriously ill, you're already over your deductible and have reached your out-of-pocket maximum, you know, a lower price is not going to really change your use very much at all. But if you're, you know, the elasticity of the responses to those lowered prices are greater for people who are at the lower end of the medical consumption distribution. So, but yes, we do rely on the economic research in that respect.
One thing I could add to that is that sometimes people make estimates of the impact of a change in price in a world in which, you know, the supply of care doesn't have a chance to respond. And as we said early on in this, we assume a fully phased-in system, so the supply system has had a chance to respond, to use, say, non-physician personnel, telemedicine, other ways that the system could become more efficient. And we assume that that the supply system has reached a new equilibrium, and that means that the supply constraints that you'd have in the short run that could be part of somebody else's estimates are not really in these estimates, because we let the system respond to meet the increased demand that's coming from the coverage reform.
You know, if that means if there are supply constraints in the short run, the cost may be lower than what we estimate, but then also the increase in access is not fully met either.
This is Sarah, too. I mean, just to put this in more simple terms, I mean, we know from years of research that people who are uninsured or underinsured use significantly less needed care than they should. And so part of the motivation for universal coverage and reducing financial barriers is to enable people to get the health care that they need. So it is, it's kind of the point of this. Some of these proposals have greater cost sharing than others, but it is what you would expect, and it is certainly what we saw after the reforms of the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you. And just as a reminder, it's star and one for any further questions today. We'll pause to allow any questions to queue. And we do have a follow-up from Ronald Brownstein with The Atlantic. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. I did have one more question. And I know you said you can't model the revenue that would be required, how you would meet the revenue that would be required here, but the magnitude of the revenue that would be required is, you know, something that I'm not aware that the federal government has ever raised in one fell swoop before. I mean, if you're talking about $2.7 trillion in 1 year, that is the 10-year estimate for the Elizabeth Warren wealth tax. I'm just wondering, is anybody, what can you even identify what might be a plausible way of raising that much money that would have any political prospects? I mean, do you think this requires, for example, a value-added tax? Would it require, I think this is more than double the amount the payroll tax is anticipated to raise over the period. What are some of the ideas that could even approach this level of cost in example eight?
You know, we haven't estimated, you know, specific revenues, but, you know, my guess is setting aside the political viability, because I won't comment on that, but that, I mean, you would have to use, I would presume you would use a mix of broad-based taxes, you know, things like additional payroll taxes, possibly a VAT You could increase income taxes on various groups, but, you know, oftentimes when you think about kind of the costs associated with spreading the costs associated with big government programs, you know, mixes of different revenue sources are often considered. So that would be my guess as to, you know, where you would want to start thinking about things.
But your your assumption is correct. It's a it is a big lift to get this kind of money, for sure.
And this is Sarah. I mean, I do want to point out, though, that the single-payer options do decrease household spending substantially. So that is a political discussion to have with people in terms of the shifting sources of how we finance our healthcare system. But it's not as if they are being increased taxes will be added on top of what people are already paying. They would actually be substituted. And for some people at the lower end of the income distribution, it would probably be a net savings for them. At the upper end of the income distribution, it might be a wash, or might be an overall net increase. But it really does have to be considered within and discussed within the context of the substantial decrease in spending that households and employers would actually experience under this.
But Sarah, I guess, Sarah, but can I mean, as I looked at the numbers, I think the decrease in household spending was in the range of $600 billion a year, and the cost is in the range of $2.8 trillion a year. So unless that's being made up entirely by weight, I mean, the cost is greater than the household savings, is it not, in your project? I mean, like five times as big.
There's also reductions in corporate spending and state spending, state and local spending, too. But, yeah, there is. That's why in Reform 8 we have a net increase in national spending, because the new spending, the new federal spending is going to offset the savings to households, employers, and state and local governments.
Right. There would be some tax, potentially tax savings from state spending going down, and some wage increases, as we noted, from employer spending going down, but we still have an increase in national health spending.
And this is David Stickall. I would just like also point out that I don't think there is any, except for the United Kingdom, which I don't think covers all of the things that that from almost every developed country with universal coverage has cost-sharing requirements of various kinds, limitations on coverage, and the result is more similar to single-payer light, which shows a decrease in total national health spending under the urban model. So Reform 8 is atypical in its comprehensiveness and extensiveness of what internationally is prevalent for the developed world.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from Shannon Firth with MedPage Today. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Shannon. Thank you for taking my question. I just wanted to talk about one of your key takeaways, that the reform ideas 5, 6, and 7 don't increase national health spending while still achieving near universal coverage. Can you flesh out a little bit how they achieve that? And what are the caveats there? Are there limitations that, for example, if you weren't using Medicare payment rates, or if you weren't doing X, you might not see that that balance? Thank you.
Sure. I mean, number one, you're absolutely right. If the payment rates for the reforms are in the marketplaces in 5 and 6, or for the single payer system in 7 or higher, you may not. We haven't done sensitivities on those with the payment rates, but you might not see, those are small decreases in national health spending. You might not achieve those if you had higher payment rates. You know, one of the ways in which the federal government costs are kept down in 5 and 6 specifically is that there's a lot of people still remaining in the employer-sponsored insurance system. They receive the tax subsidy that we have in current law for employer-based insurance contributions by employers, but they're not being additionally subsidized here in the marketplaces. We retain premium contributions that are income-related for households to be spending, and out-of-pocket costs that are income-related. So all of those keep dollars in the private sector. In addition, state governments are continuing to help finance the Medicaid program in those reforms, and all of those help to reduce costs. They also are leaving the undocumented population outside of these reforms. In 5 and 6, the undocumented population can still buy private insurance with their own funds or through their employer, but they are not being subsidized through the marketplace subsidies. Under 7, the more dollars are being shifted onto the federal side and away from the private side than in 5 and 6, but you've got the lower provider payment rates, and you still have some income-related cost sharing, and the benefits are more limited than what you see in Reform 8. They're consistent with the Affordable Care Act benefits, just like 5 and 6, the reforms 5 and 6 are. So those are really the big pieces. Did I forget?
5, 6, and 7 don't cover undocumented immigrants, and 8 does. So
that's certainly part of it. But, yeah, if you ended up, for example, setting the provider payment rates quite a bit higher, national health spending might well be increasing instead of decreasing a little bit here.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Merrill Guzner with Modern Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Yeah, going back to something said very earlier, that none of these plans are based on anything that is specific to a piece of legislation. Was there nothing on the conservative side that you found worthy of analysis in thinking about how to bring down the uninsured rate from where we are today? I could outline some ideas, but I'm just kind of curious as if you took a look at some things and just simply rejected them, or that you never really considered some alternative approaches that at least some think tanks I know talk about.
Well, we did. One of the things that we've done this year is we have modeled the implications of full repeal of the ACA, as that is supported by the current administration, and we do have estimates out on that, and those are state-by-state estimates if you're interested in it. During 2017, we estimated a whole array of repeal and replace proposals that were being supported by the Republican Congress. So we have done a wide array of those kinds of reforms as well. This was a specific look at this set of proposals, but we expect to do more as more reform proposals are developed on all sides.
We would be delighted to model proposals introduced by the administration, by the Republican Study Committee, which is rumored to be developing a plan. But they are not as well formulated as the plans that are available from the other side of the aisle.
Okay, can I do a follow-up on that?
Sure.
On the other side, I'm looking at the single-payer plans. At least one of the Democratic candidates has talked about single-payer, but doing it with Medicare Advantage and competing rather than no private insurance option, as you've outlined in the two single-payer plans here. There's the idea of having the private insurance companies compete by selling different versions of a Medicare for All plan, like Medicare for All. Did you not consider that, or is there nothing concrete enough to take a look at?
I think that kind of approach would likely have very similar results to Reform 8. But we had to limit just how many we could do in this, in one paper, because already 8 and 3 sensitivities on 2 of those is a huge amount of information. There's actually a lot more data in the full report, even than in the brief, that I think you've all had access to. So it is something that we've talked about possibly doing, but we didn't think that for purposes of this, which we really wanted to give some benchmarks on the broad spectrum of options being discussed, that would give results that were so substantially different than Reform 8 that it made sense to add it as another one here, and we were just trying to limit how much we were throwing at everybody at one time.
It was also introduced fairly, and most of this work was already well along, too.
Yeah. but it is something that we'll think about whether it makes sense for us to look at that in the future.
Thank you. And it does appear we have no further questions. I'll return the floor to our presenters for any closing remarks.
Thank you very much for your attention and for your questions. Thanks, Linda and John, and the Urban Institute. If you need additional information, we will be available this afternoon. And I just want to remind you that the embargo for this report lifts at 12:01 a.m. tomorrow.